This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, John DiNardo, who received his degree in science education at Keene University, most of his electives in physics and biology. He taught high school physics and then returned to electronics, which was his original career, during 4.5 years of service in the Marine Corps. John, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Jim.
If you have an introductory statement you'd like to make, you're welcome.
Yeah, well, the introductory statement of thesis of this entire discussion is that the global elite, the people who control the world behind the scenes, are in deadly intent on exterminating most of the people in this world. And to show you that this is not hyperbole, they have engraved this determination in stone. They have stated it in stone at the Georgia Guidestones in a place in Georgia which is well known, and you can find this on the actual film footage of the Georgia Guidestones, wherein the elite have stated that they intended to reduce the population of the world to 500 million. Now, there are 6.5 billion people in the world. That means they would have to kill 12 out of every 13 people alive today.
Depopulating the world of 6 billion people, it sounds like quite a project. I've heard, you know, various rumors or remarks, and of course the Georgia Guidestone is a very interesting case, but it seems, you know, so incredible that anybody, even a powerful group of interest, could be so intent on the extinction of such an enormous percentage of humanity that I have been simply dumbfounded at the very thought.
Yes, incredible. And the fact that someone as knowledgeable as you about deep politics would still be astounded indicates that the common individual would even be disbelieving of such an insidious plot, and that common individual would therefore tend to ignore it and certainly tend to remain inactive in protecting himself and the entire and all of humankind from this insidious plot. So that's the danger, is people's disbelief and people's apathy. But thank goodness that they have created these Georgia Guidestones, where they declare in stone their intent to exterminate 12 out of every 13 people on planet Earth. And not only do we have the Georgia Guidestones, but we have National Security Study Memorandum 200, NSSM 200. Incidentally, everyone listening, please get a pencil and paper, pen and paper, and jot down certain key words, because I'm going to ask people to get involved and to help us out so that we can actually go beyond informing the people to actually getting people involved on the playing field of life. Because if we don't get involved on a playing field of life, we'll all be lying on the playing field of death.
John, I had a previous guest who mentioned the Georgia Guidestones, and he, as I recall, he wasn't clear who had established them, who had paid for them, who had them erected there. Can you tell us anything about that and why that site might have been selected?
I don't know why. The site was selected because of its granite deposits. It's a granite quarry. And of course, these stones are very heavy, and I guess it was a convenient place to put them. Now, there may be other symbolic reasons, but I can tell you that the man who paid for this, it was quite an expensive venture, of course. The man who paid for this gave a pseudonym to the people who actually made the stones themselves. He did not want to reveal his identity. And this man gave his pseudonym of John, I think it was John D. Christian. And he was evidently working for the power elite in putting up these Georgia Guidestones. When you look at the message on it, you can see that this is an elitist message where they would bring the entire world together under common religion, a common government, and exterminate most of the people. If you look at the, it's very difficult to create an altruistic backdrop or reason or excuse for such a plan. It's very difficult to seem altruistic when you want to kill off, you know, commit what I call humanicide.
Humanicide, yeah, good term.
But they've done it, and they've boldly done it, but we are intelligent enough to see through their transparent guise of world. They want to create world harmony and have world peace and have everybody loving one another and no more national sovereignty so that we can have no more wars. But it's obvious that this is just another plan for global dictatorship. Men throughout the ages have lusted after global dictatorship, and now they're at the point of achieving it.
John, you know, I've heard estimates of trying to reduce the world's population to 2 billion. Half a million is considerably less than that. If you consider it a half a million in relation to the surface area of the Earth, you're going to have a minuscule population per square mile. I mean, I haven't done a calculation, but it's obviously going to be tiny. I just don't know how most of the habitable areas of Earth would be manageable, how you could do anything with them with that kind of population density or lack thereof.
Well, your comment brings up another important point, and that is it shows, it's another example of the insidious, deceitful, duplicitous approach that they're taking in telling us that the world is so overpopulated that we cannot support, you know, 13 or 6.5 billion people. It shows that we do have far more land than is necessary to support even the 6.5 billion people that we have on Earth. True, there is starvation, and it's true that we should limit population because population does increase exponentially. Getting back to
just a comment, John. It would seem to me the humane way to reduce the rate of growth is through sex education, Planned Parenthood, the use of contraception, and all that. In other words, you know. Instruction in the methods of family planning, which tend to reduce the sizes of families, and which would, I think, within a relatively brief period of time, a generation or so, considerably alter the rate of growth and probably actually initiate a general reduction, even if very gradual, in the population of Earth.
Yes, you're right. That is the only humane way to keep the population from, quote, exploding. Now, you're getting back to your comment about the population being so thin that they could never, they would have difficulty in sustaining modern society. I think the power elite probably plan to have their very reduced population occupying certain areas of the planet after they assume control of the world. But here's another factor that enters into it that people need to be aware of, and it's really totally unknown. It's largely unknown among the people, even among researchers, and that is the fact that the world is about ready to go into, be afflicted with global natural disasters that are as a result of incoming comets. Earthquakes will be increasing, volcanic eruptions will be increasing, and the power elite, in fact, are going underground right now. We have absolute film documentation that they have created not billion-dollar cities, but trillion-dollar cities at 129 locations around the globe. All the major governments and the power elite throughout the world know about this incoming celestial gravitational and electromagnetic effects, devastation of Earth that is on the horizon, and that is now increasing steadily.
John, I know you've done a lot of research on this. Are we talking about a potential collision or a near miss where the gravitational attraction, et cetera, is going to be the disruptive force, or is this potentially even more calamitous?
Ancient history has shown us that this will be a near miss. There is such, scientists have discovered what is called repulsion forces between large bodies. This is a large body. It's a brown dwarf star. It has been detected by astronomers for, going back about 2.25 centuries, astronomers have noticed that there is a massive celestial body out beyond the outer planets that is so large that it exerts gravitational pull on the outer planets, Uranus and Neptune. And ever since the year around the beginning of the 1800s, they have noticed it, and they immediately knew that there must be some huge gravitational
pull. Well, are we talking about something that has the potential to disrupt the solar system, the planets and their orbits around the sun?
Yes. They have
this could be out there. This could be a truly, you're talking about a truly cosmic event in relation to Earth.
Yes, and this really figures in as the major factor in why the New World Order is racing so frantically to institute their New World Order and to exterminate 12 out of every 13 people on Earth, because they're planning to go underground to escape the natural disasters. They're scared to death because they don't know if their underground cities are going to be able to support them, if they're going to be viable amidst the earthquake activity that's going to occur underground. You might say, why would they be going underground? Well, you know, I hate to hit people with all this information all at one time, but solar scorching, according to the National Academy of Science, which is, as scientist Larry Joseph says, the National Academy of Science is the supreme court of science in the United States. And according to the National Academy of Science and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and this is also echoed by famed astrophysicist Dr. Michio Kaku, the Earth is about to go through, endure solar scorching because of very intense, unprecedentedly great solar blasting, solar winds, solar flares, solar coronal mass ejections, probably the end of this year and next year.
Well, John, this sounds like a phenomenon that would bring about the death of a vast number of human beings on Earth. I mean, why? It sounds to me as though that might be, just let these events take place and there's going to be a dramatic reduction in Earth population.
Well, you know, this has always mystified me, too, this fact that they know there's going to be great devastation of the human race, and I believe they must logically conclude that, yeah, let's just go underground and just let everybody die. Why they're continuing with their plan of extermination by way of food and other means, I don't know. I mean,
go ahead, John.
I mean, perhaps they feel that they'll be caught before they get it, or and uprooted from their underground cities by the infuriated mobs who are starving and being, you know, being destroyed by the natural disasters. They know that people go into chaotic violence when natural disasters occur, and people might try to get into those underground cities, and of course they would be uprooted and hung, you know, torn to pieces by the mobs. Maybe that's what they're afraid of, and that's why they want to kill us with disease, plagues, which are coming with the new, as you know, the swine flu, avian flu vaccine. That's a whole different story. That's a whole new story on its own merit. Which shows that they're planning to create, to debilitate and decimate much of the population with the new plagues that are coming. But also the GMO food, genetically modified organisms, are weakening people and causing grave illness over a long period of time, because we know genetically modified foods are not compatible with the human body. These molecules are foreign to the body, and any time foreign molecules become incorporated into our cells, the body gradually becomes cancerous and plagued and debilitated. So why are they doing all this stuff to kill us? I don't know, when they know that the natural disasters are going to be a quick, easy way to do the job.
Well, let me make another point, too, which is this, that, you know, Monsanto promotes the genetically engineered corn and all that. But if, in fact, it's going to have this these debilitating effects on those who consume their products, there are going to be many fewer who are going to be in the position to consume them. I mean, they're reducing their target population, it would seem to me, of those who are going to, you know, buy their products, their foodstuffs for the sake of consumption, and thereby putting themselves out of business.
Yeah, well, you know, just by killing 12 out of 13 people on a planet, they're putting themselves out of business too. But, you know, it's often been stated by researchers that money is not their goal. They've got more money than they ever need. In fact, in the famed documentary by Alex Jones, Endgame, there is Dr. Michael Kaufman says, "It's people don't understand. They're not after money. They got more money than they could ever consume. They're after power."
Well, but so, if you know, power generally is measured as a function over how much land and people you control, and if you are dramatically reducing the Earth's population, you're also commensurately reducing the scope of your power to those who remain, which are going to be a tiny percentage of the original population. And let me ask two or three more related questions here, John. One is, if they go underground and this scorched Earth takes place, it's going to have devastating effects on the flora and fauna. I mean, it's going to, you know, destroy the agricultural lands and the forests and have other devastating effects, which means if they eventually emerge out of their cocoons beneath the ground, they're not going to have the resources necessary for a sustainable form of life, it would seem to me. I mean, how long can you eat Spam or K-rations underground?
That's true. I mean, they are well-stocked for a long enough period of time, I believe. They've studied this very carefully. They have the best geologists and the best scientists and the best engineers money can buy. That's our money, our tax money. Mm-hmm. And they have been building these underground cities for decades. I mean, going back to 30, 40 years ago, they've been constructing these cities. Certain people who are engineers in that construction have spoken out, like Philip Schneider, and he was murdered. But you know, they have no choice. The bottom line is they have no choice. This planet is coming at us, and they know that their plans are faulty, may have some faulty aspects to them, and they may not be in complete safety, but they've got no choice.
Well, let me just illustrate, you know, the unexpected effects of these, you know, deliberate actions that can make a devastating difference. They're going to have some form of exhaust, right, for waste in the air and so forth to be exuded out of their underground establishments on Earth. But what if, you know, these devastating effects should cap the exhaust vents? Then they're going to be suffocated by their own pollution in the air underground, about which they can do nothing.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, you're talking about, like, being polluted and poisoned by gases underground.
That's right, because their exhaust mechanisms have been destroyed by effects beyond their control that you're describing here.
Well, yeah, I mean, as I say, they are doing their very best with the best engineers, the best scientists possible to construct a viable city that will withstand all kinds of natural disasters, and they're praying and hoping, well, not praying, I don't think they pray, but they're hoping that their scientists have given them a system of air venting and air purification and food provisions that will keep them alive and well throughout this horrible crisis.
Well, John, I'll just make an observation that
so they're doing their best, but you know they know that they're scared. They know that they've got no choice but to do their very best.
Well, John, I mean, you know, this is going to be very high tech, right? It's going to be sophisticated. A lot of it's going to become controlled by computerized mechanisms and all that. But these components can fail. You know, computers can crash. There are all kinds of ways in which there are going to be hazards to their scheme, and which can defeat their idea of living for a sustainable period of time. And I'm not quite sure how long they're contemplating, but suppose it were a year, I would say the probability of being able to go a year underground in one of these sophisticated arrangements without something unexpected happening has got to approach zero.
Yeah, I don't know. I do know that they have spent literally trillions of dollars. They've gotten the best engineers and scientists that money can buy, and they're crossing their fingers. They know that if they had their own choice, they would have this brown dwarf star that's approaching the sun, that's being gravitationally drawn in by our sun. If they had their own choice, they would say, go away, brown dwarf star, so that we don't have to go through this. But they are in the midst of a crisis that is beyond human intervention, beyond human control, and they know it. And they are scared, but they figure they've done their very best. In fact, let me give you an example of how concerned and worried they are right now. I've been in contact, fortunate enough to make contact with a couple people who have been involved in geological studies, and not direct contact, but direct contact through somebody that knew them, and also oceanographic studies. And what I've learned is that these are some of the earthquakes that have occurred have actually been created by HARP deliberately at the depths and in the locales, I believe, I know that at the depths at which these underground cities are constructed, because they wanted to test the viability, survivability of these underground cities by actually creating earthquakes to see how well they can withstand the earthquakes that are coming.
Yeah, but earthquakes the earthquakes are of many degrees of magnitude, as we all know. And the fact that it could sustain the test earthquake doesn't mean it can sustain the range of violence, upheaval of the earth that is going to take place. I think this whole thing is really fantastic and based upon assumptions that are almost certainly going to turn out to be false.
Well, that's why they're scared, because they have no other choice. There's a cannonball coming at us, coming at them too, and they know it. And if they had their choice, they would say, please, go turn around and go back. Mm. But they cannot. This is well beyond anything that can be controlled by the greatest power of mankind on Earth. Mankind is completely ineffectual against this threat that's coming. So the only thing they can do is do their very best, and that's why they're so scared.
Let me make one more point before we take our first break, which is this. Suppose they were underground for a year while scorched earth is taking place above them. That would include all the mechanisms, all the machinery, all the gas and oil resources that are above ground, etc., that haven't already been, you know, pulled out from under the earth's crust. I mean, when they come up, they're going to be looking at a junkyard. And since the earth depopulation is taking place, all the people who would normally be involved in maintaining the equipment, performing the menial tasks, changing the oil, etc., are going to be unavailable permanently. I mean, the whole thing is a horror story, it seems to me, from beginning to end.
It is. It is. You know, but they've tried to prepare for the workforce, prepare a workforce to go down there with them. And this is what I've been told, too, that by several sources, that they're looking around for some of the best people, the most competent people in various fields, to go down there with them and be part of their workforce. And that's why they want to maintain the population, you know, hopefully, once they come above ground, at $500 million, so that $500 million can be an obedient and proficient workforce to support them. So, yeah, I mean, they're worried, they're concerned, And they know that there's no real there's no real viability, a verifiable way to protect themselves. All they can do is do their very best, and they're quite uncertain about the outcome.
John, we're taking our first break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest today, John DiNardo. We're talking about catastrophes yet to come, for which there appears to be considerable evidence. We'll be right back. Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, John DiNardo, who has earned his bachelor's degree in science education from Keene University. He's completed many courses in electrical engineering and advanced mathematics and other subjects. He worked for 20 years as an electrical engineer and designer of electronic circuitry with Bell in Whippany, New Jersey. And he has been studying for some time the phenomenon referred to by the astronomical community as Planet X, including reading Mark Hazelwood's book, Blindsided. John, why don't you tell us a little about that?
Okay. When I first heard about the book Blindsided about Planet X, I immediately knew. I guess it was some kind of an intuitive knowledge. I knew that this was true, and I'll tell you, I guess it was understanding of Bible prophecy, too, that showed me that there's something that's coming that's going to be devastating to the earth. Perhaps the understanding of Bible prophecy gave me that intuitive feeling that it was true.
Yeah, but John, look, I mean, you know, this is, I'm an agnostic. I don't believe in the Bible. There are many wise things observed in the Bible, but prophecy for me, with my background in the history and philosophy of science, is not going to be a basis for anticipating the occurrence of astronomical events, which are, I'm very interested in the scientific foundation as opposed to any prophetic claims that may be made, which are enormously vague and subject to multiple interpretations.
Okay. I went to the library and I photocopied the New York Times article. This is a landmark article, and I can email it to you. It's high resolution. It's the actual New York Times article from Sunday, January 30th, 1983.
Yes.
The title is Clues Get Warm and the Search for Planet X.
Tell us more. Just why don't you read key parts of it to us? Because not everyone has access to this article, so, you know.
Right. Clues Get Warm and the Search for Planet X by John Noble Wilford. Quote, something
who,
out
who,
there...
Who, by the way, is a very esteemed or was science editor for the New York Times. This guy is a serious person.
Quote, something out there beyond the farthest reaches of the known solar system seems to be tugging at Uranus and Neptune. Some gravitational force keeps perturbing the two giant planets, causing irregularities in their orbits. The force suggests a presence far away and unseen, a large object that may be the long-sought Planet X. Evidence assembled in recent years has led several groups of astronomers to renew the search for this 10th planet. They are devoting more time to visual observations with the 200-inch telescope at Mount Palomar. They're tracking two Pioneer spacecraft now approaching the orbit of distant Pluto to see if variations in their trajectories provide clues to the source of this mysterious force. And they are hoping that a satellite-borne telescope launched last week will detect heat signatures from this planet or whatever it is out there. This is the infrared astronomical satellite boosted into a 560-mile high polar orbit Tuesday night from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. Well, I can go on and on, but basically what it tells you is that they were so determined to find this massive gravitational force out beyond the outer planets that was tugging gravitationally at the outer planets in their orbital rotation or revolution that they sent up this infrared astronomical satellite. It had to have an infrared eyes because this planet was not emitting visible light. Very dark planet.
Yes.
So, and it goes on to state in the article that for over 200 years, this massive gravitational body has been mathematically calculated to exist out there at a particular point, and they believe that it's within. This is a key statement in this article. They believe that it is within the gravitational influence of our sun. This is what they stated scientifically in the New York Times in 1983, that it is within the gravitational influence of our sun. Well, there you go. This proves to you right now that this object must be attracted.
Well, what's the relative
accelerated into our solar system at this moment?
What's the relative mass of these objects? I mean, is the sun attracting it, or is it attracting the sun? I mean, the universe law of the inverse square law of universal gravitation. I mean, objects attract one another directly proportional to their masses, and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. But if they're closing, then of course the gravitational attraction between them is going to increase dramatically.
Exactly. Now, the relative size is such that the sun will not move, but Planet X will be pulled in at an increasing velocity.
So Planet X is a relatively small mass in relation to the mass of our sun.
Right, and from all the studies I've done, from the statements from scientists in the past, and the inside information that I've tried to glean, and other people working in parallel with me have tried to glean, we figure that this body is about 1.1 to 1.2 times the volume of Jupiter. Now, we know that it's basically a same type of body as Jupiter, and that is, it's a gas giant, and it's approaching, it's a brown dwarf star. Jupiter is almost, not quite big enough to be a brown dwarf star, but approaching that type of celestial body.
Now, brown dwarf star,
it's more dense. This is a little bit more dense than Jupiter and a little bit greater in volume. So we can do a simple arithmetic. Go ahead, Jim.
Go ahead. I was just going to talk about the brown dwarfs being a stage in the evolution of these kinds of bodies.
Right. The brown dwarf is, you know, astrophysicists believe that stars are formed by space cosmic dust that swirls and begins to collect gravitationally, because gravity is a force that is universal. And particles of this dust clump together, they aggregate, and because of their mutually attracted to one another. And as they aggregate, it's like a snowball, rolling a snowball, it gets larger and larger as you roll it. Likewise, when these particles aggregate and the swirling masses of clouds and cosmic dust, they begin to get larger and larger, and the density increases, because now the gravitational force at the nucleus of this aggregating body becomes greater and greater. The pulling force, the inward pulling force toward the center point of this body becomes greater. And now that increases its density, because you have more atoms clustered closer together per unit volume. So this massive of cosmic dust gets greater and greater as it builds up, and sometimes it never gets large enough to actually get so dense and so compacted and with so much pressure that it actually creates nuclear fusion and begins to light up and become a sun or a star, just like our sun. It doesn't get that big, and it just remains as a baby star or a incipient.
But, given the multiple gravitational forces affecting it, how close is it going to come to our solar system? Is there any prospect it could hit the sun, and what would happen if it were to?
Okay, before I answer that real quickly, I'll tell you that we estimate that the mass of this brown dwarf star is probably between 500 and 1,000 Earth masses. Jupiter is about 318. Jupiter is estimated to be 318 Earth masses. This brown dwarf star, excuse me, being somewhat larger than Jupiter, is estimated to be between 500 and 1,000 Earth masses. Now, the Sun is one-third of a million Earth masses. So the Sun is 330 times the mass of this brown dwarf star. So the Sun ain't going to move. It's this brown dwarf that's going to be drawn in. Now, when it comes in below the ecliptic plane. The ecliptic plane is sort of like a revolving circular tabletop that you might visualize a tabletop in a restaurant. And at the center of the table would be a lamp, which would represent the sun. And on this table, you might place some certain objects at varying distances from the center to represent the various planets. This thing comes up more or less like somebody shooting a ball bearing from a slingshot. Somebody lying on the floor below this table, but off to the side of the table, not directly below it, but on the floor, directly to the side, off to the side, shooting it to the underside of the table. Okay, toward the center of the table, because its trajectory is going to be in line with the sun. The sun is what's sucking it in. And when it goes through the table, it doesn't hit the sun. It actually loops around through Jupiter, around the orbital path of Jupiter, just a little bit on the sunward side of Jupiter. The reason I know this, or the reason I believe this, is because there are a couple of reasons. One is the ancient historians from Nineveh and Babylon, as recorded by Zechariah Sitchin in his landmark book, The Twelfth Planet. These ancient historians and astronomers had stated that it does come up. They called it Nibiru, which means planet of the crossing. That it comes up around what they call, in ancient texts, the station of Jupiter. Now, the station would imply the orbital path, where Jupiter hangs out. Well, Jupiter hangs out in an orbital path around the sun. It takes 11 years for Jupiter to make one revolution around the sun. So this thing comes in around that big ring, that imaginary ring, of which is called Jupiter's orbital path, just a little bit inward from Jupiter. Now, another reason why I believe it comes in from Jupiter is that we have what is called the asteroid belt, which is a circular trail of debris, space rocks, asteroids, all kinds of space junk that has been somehow created, probably by a collision. And the collision would most likely have occurred by, been created by this planet X as it came through. But not
millions of years ago.
Pardon me?
Millions of years ago.
Yes. Now, nobody knows because nobody was there. But you can look at some of the evidence, and now you couple the two, the reports. One is it comes up between Jupiter. Now, these astronomers actually had the ability in ancient times. They had higher technology than we really believe. But they were able to see fireworks on Jupiter. Now, the fireworks are actually electrical discharges. When two planets get close together, especially one which is saturated with plasma, that's electrified gases, it becomes like a zapping machine. You know, when you walk across a carpet, your body picks up lots of static charge. And if you go to touch a metal object on a cold, dry day, you can get a real severe sting from the electrical discharge from the electrons from your body to that metal car handle. So this is what happens to celestial bodies, one of which is saturated, like Planet X, because it's saturated with plasma as it punches through the plasma spherical heliosphere surrounding our entire solar system. That's a plasma sphere, actually, that blocks and protects our solar system from cosmic rays. And this plasma sphere is actually created by blowout from the sun. The sun keeps on blowing smoke like a man smoking a cigar. The sun continually blows out solar winds, which are primarily, which are plasma that is positively charged hydrogen ions. And they collect at the outer borders of our, way beyond Pluto, the outer borders of our solar system. So now Planet X comes in, punches through that heliosphere, picks up all that sticky, electrically sticky plasma, and as it passes by any surrounding bodies, if it gets close enough, it's going to zap and discharge. Well, that's what the ancients used to see, and that's what they had reported. So that's one reason, another reason why we believe that it comes in near Jupiter. Now, it loops around. It's going to make a loop around the sun, because if you look at basic physics, and you realize that these two bodies can never collide with one another because of what's called repulsion forces between large masses, then what it does is loop around. And visualize yourself fishing, or someone you know fishing. He's got this long fishing line, and he reels in a fish. That fish represents Planet X. You, the fisherman, represent the sun. And your fishing line represents the gravitational force of attraction between Planet X and the sun. So are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Now, as that fish visualizes fish in slow motion, you're pulling it in. And then, and all the while, there's a tensile force being pulled on the fish, so this fish is accelerating. As long as the force is applied to it, it is accelerating. But then now the fish gets to a point where he's directly over your head. And now you're no longer pulling the fish toward you, but the fish is pulling away from you, and you have to yank back in the opposite direction on that fishing line in order to pull that fish back. Well, what's going to happen? The force of the sun is now changing from accelerating the Planet X toward the sun, but it's changing to pulling Planet X back, decelerating Planet X by pulling it back toward the sun. And the result is that it constantly curves and curves and curves away from its what it wants to be, its inertially guided straight line. Inertia, the law of inertia states that a body tends to move at a constant velocity, meaning constant speed and a constant direction, same direction. So it's got that inertia. It wants to go straight.
Yeah, less acted upon by external forces, of course.
Right, and that external force is the pullback force of the sun as it begins to overshoot the sun. And that's what causes it to loop around. And it must pick up tremendous amount of pulling force as it loops around the sun. It must come, in my mind, my way of thinking, this planet X must be pulled awfully close to the sun in order to create a tremendous gravitational pull, because as you stated, the gravitational force of attraction between two bodies is inversely proportional to the distance between them squared, which means as planet X is being pulled ever closer to the sun, gravitational force pulling back by the sun is increasing at a tremendous exponential rate mm-hmm. such that Planet X gets enough whipping force to slingshot it back out into deep space by the sun.
Yes.
It must come awfully close to the sun in order to exert such a tremendous solar gravitational force.
What are the calculations of the periodicity, the cycling effect here? How long does it take for this Planet X to, repeat one of these cycles?
How long it takes, we found out from ancient history that it takes, it's pretty predictable, about 36 and a half centuries. 36 and a half centuries.
3,650 years.
Right. Now, if we look back 36 and a half centuries, we see signs from various fields of study indicating that the Earth went through major catastrophes worldwide. We see tree rings worldwide 36 and a half centuries ago are very much narrowed, meaning indicating that the atmosphere,
the resources available to them, were dramatically reduced.
Right. And what happens is this planet, as it comes by, when gravitational and magnetic forces are exerted by a passing brown dwarf star on planet Earth, what happens is it heats up the Earth's mostly molten iron core, and of course that results in the magma, the mantle
expansion
of the Earth getting also very hot, and volcanic eruptions occur all over the planet. In fact, many of the extinct volcanoes are extinct only because they were created during this great catastrophe by the heating of the Earth, and then after it
subsided, they became dormant.
They became dormant.
It lost the heat that was producing the eruptions, etc. The expansion lost the heat that was creating the expansion of the magma and the eruptions through these little openings, little pores, as it were.
That's right. And now all those dormant volcanoes are very much prone to becoming active again. In fact, even more new volcanoes can be created. But there are hundreds of volcanic dormant volcanoes on the Earth, and that's what happened. They all erupted at the same time, and the entire Earth became enveloped. Earth's atmosphere became enveloped by a black cloud of ash, volcanic ash.
You know what happened
with Mount St. Helens.
Right. You don't have to be actually in the lava flow to suffer devastating effects, because the pollution of the atmosphere is such that you'll be incapable of obtaining sufficient oxygen when you breathe this polluted atmosphere. And that will no doubt bring about the largest form of extinction of living things. It'll be the pollution of the atmosphere.
That's right. And, Jim, you just caused me to realize that that's another reason why the elite are going underground. Not only because of the solar scorching, but because of the pollution, the poisonous gases that will envelop our entire planet.
Yeah, and of course, they're presuming that if they stay above ground, that their prospects are extremely dismal, and that even if disappearing below ground doesn't give them guarantees, it's got a higher probability by their calculation of ensuring their survival than remaining above ground.
There you go. They have no choice. They have to do their very best. They are scared. It's not as if they figure, oh, we've got everything figured out and we're going to be safe. No. These people are very scared going underground, but they know that they have no choice whatsoever. It's either go underground or stay above ground and be killed.
So, and of course, they're not going to release this information to the general public for fear of generating widespread panic and hysteria.
Exactly. Even if they were an altruistic, loving leadership, which they are, you know, they're
manifestly not.
Evil group. Even if they were altruistic, they would never tell us for fear of generating panic, as you say.
What's the timeline? We have evidence,
so much evidence that 36 and a half centuries ago, this planet passed by. But I'm sorry, go ahead, Jim.
No, I was just going to say, what's the timeline? How soon are we going to begin to feel these effects?
You know, a lot of people ask me that, and I have to be honest and say that I'm not sure, because it's very difficult. I don't know the velocity of this object, but I can tell you from my studies, and I don't see anybody else doing any, not even scientists, looking into this. I feel like, hey, I'm not even a fireman, and I'm here to put out the fire. Where's the fire trucks?
John, I think it has to be.
Scientists aren't doing it, but what I found is I've done some studying. I think I can give you some information as to the timeline. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it has to be calculable. You may not have all the variables, but I mean, it seems to me that we ought to be able to make at least a very good approximation. And I think the concern, too, is going to be that the effects, of course, are going to be initially more gradual and then become more and more severe as it approaches closer and closer. So we're going to have a kind of a sequence of levels of damage, destruction, and devastation that's going to take place over a period of time that probably is not very extensive.
Yes, what I've read is what you're saying is like waves of intense, ever-increasing waves of destruction. We've had waves of destruction with the Chilean earthquake, the Haitian earthquake, the New Zealand earthquake, the Japan earthquake. What else? I know there's been so many devastating earthquakes. And then we've had another wave with the great tornado outbreak. Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Joplin, Missouri, leveled for miles and miles to turn into nothing but rubble. We've had straight-line windstorms all over the country. Even New York City was hit by tornadoes. I mean, we've had epic flooding. I've got so much of it recorded because I think I'm the only person in the country who has like 250 to 300 hours of nothing but severe weather reports from the Weather Channel videotaped. I spend many hours of my life videotaping nothing but severe weather reports from the Weather Channel starting back in 2004 up until 2010, when I just gave up because I just had so much I could never deal with it all. But the disasters are increasing at an intensifying rate, and it comes in waves, apparently. Ancient historians have implied that these waves do occur. It's not like a smooth, linear increase in natural disasters. So we can expect more severe waves pretty soon. I'm afraid of Japan having another earthquake.
John, we got to take our second break. Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, John DiNardo. We're talking about potential forthcoming catastrophe on Earth. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest today, John DiNardo. We're talking about Planet X and related phenomena, not to mention plans by the global elite to bring about massive depopulation of Earth, which may, if these events we're discussing come to pass, happen on a devastating scale anyhow. But John, here's a question that occurs to me. We're talking about ancient historians and all that. I mean, the human population is here. If this was last happened 3,650 years ago, how it cannot have been so devastating that the human species didn't survive since we're here now. So what do we say about that?
Every time it passes, it depends on how close it comes to Earth. You know, Earth is in on that revolving circular table that I just described.
Sure, the ecliptic, and, yeah. It's like, just for the understanding of the general audience, if they haven't thought about it, the planets aren't willy-nilly in spheres, you know, located at different positions. They're all on a plane, as though they were all located as different points on a record, and that when they move through space, there's a relative stability in that plane, relative to which, think of the sun as like the spindle on a 45 record player, except, of course, it's a ball in space, and you get the idea that these planets are all revolving, but roughly on the same plane with minor variation.
That's right. And so if you visualize that revolving table with, again, like a record of or a compact disc, or the revolving table, you have... Let's say Mercury is a little bit out from the center of the lamp,
sure,
of that table, and Mercury is represented by a cranberry. And we'll skip a couple planets. We'll say that Earth is, then it's Venus.
Well, we got
then
Venus and Mars. You can go through them all, John. There aren't that many.
Okay. Then you have Mercury, and then for a little further out from the sun, there's Venus. Mercury might be a cranberry. Earth. Venus and then Earth might be represented by a grape, and then Mars might be represented by a pea, and then you've got the asteroid belt, which is a circular ring of debris, which we believe, and many ancient historians believe, was created by a collision of one of Planet X's shotgun pellets, actually. Planet X drags in a lot of major comets along with it because of its gravitational pull. It's like a vacuum cleaner. So when it in space, it picks up all kinds of space bodies, asteroids.
Sort of a flattened ring of granola or grape nuts or whatever, something really finely crushed.
That's right. That's what the asteroid belt might be portrayed as, because it's debris. And as we say, we believe it was caused by Planet X coming in on the outer side, away from the sun, on the outer side of that asteroid belt ring of debris, which is right between the debris of the asteroid belt and Jupiter, which is the next larger planet out. And Jupiter might be represented in your mind's eye by a grapefruit compared to the grape-sized planet Earth.
You haven't represented the sun yet, which is going to be enormous.
Yeah, the sun would be a huge lamp, and we can't get the size proportion exactly right unless, you know, that the lamp would have to be awfully big. But in answer to your question,
minimally think of it as a watermelon or an enormous pumpkin.
Yes, right, and even that would not be big enough.
Sufficient.
Because remember,
right,
the sun is 330,000 Earth masses, whereas Jupiter is only 318. I say that facetiously. Jupiter is only 318 Earth masses.
Yeah.
So now you had asked why didn't we have total devastation of the Earth during the last battle?
Right. Given that humanity is still here, it cannot have been a complete devastation, or that wouldn't be the case.
Well, we've had serious disasters on Earth in the past, from at 36 and a half century multiples of time. And we've had not so serious disasters, depending on where Earth happens to be. So now you've got in your mind's eye this revolving table, and Earth is that grape that's revolving just like all the others, as the table itself revolves. The table is actually an invisible plane in space, called the ecliptic. So if Planet X comes up like that ball bearing that we were talking about, being fired from a slingshot by some guy lying on the floor off to the side of the table, it goes, the ball bearing travels upward toward the center of the table, but not exactly in the center, so it punches through the underside of the table, just on the sunward side, a little bit inward from Jupiter, but a little bit outward from the orbital path of the asteroid belt. Punches through the table. Now the sun is trying to pull it back, like that fisherman pulling that fish. As the fish travels over his head and starts to overshoot the fisherman, which is the sun, tries to pull back the fish, which is Planet X. So the ball bearing, again, shift your mind back to the ball bearing punching through the table. That ball bearing is going to loop over the top of the table as it punches through near that grapefruit, Jupiter. It's going to loop over the top of the orbital path and travel over the sun. But on its way over the sun, that lamp, which is in the middle of the table, it has to first pass over the orbital path of the asteroid belt, then over the orbital path of Mars, then over the orbital path of Earth and over Venus, and over that of Mercury, and then finally over the top of the sun, where the sun is going to accelerate it and slingshot it back down through the tabletop again, where it would travel back out into deep space.
That's really because it's acquiring increased inertia as it approaches the sun, whose gravitational attraction is pulling it closer and closer to the sun, and while it doesn't enter into the sun physically, it comes close to it, and with all that acquired momentum continues into outer space, as you describe it, as a slingshot effect.
Right. Now I'm going to read, because this all sounds quite fantastic to your listeners, I'm going to read you some quite convincing clips or segments, passages from the New York Times, 1983, and I'm trying to find my Washington Post article, which is a landmark. But in the New York Times, 1983 article, which I began reading previously, it says here, recent calculations, this is New York Times, you can go to your library, or I'll try to...
This is when the Times was more reliable, in my opinion. I mean, it's become a kind of a mouthpiece for the government on a wide range of issues. And you wouldn't expect articles of the accuracy of what you found there to be appearing today, even in relation to the same, very same issue.
Yeah, and you're right. And also, there's another factor, and that is that the power elite who controls the National Security Agency, which in turn controls all of the government agencies, the Central Intelligence Agency, including the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, this National Security Agency was not quite on their toes because they didn't have the scientific background, so they were not immediately prepared to suppress this information. Some of it came out through the honest, sincere, and excited scientists at NASA and at some of the other astronomical agencies and observatories, which were non-government related. So they really, they sometimes miss in suppressing the truth, and sometimes truth does get out. And this article, quoting recent, this is a quote from January 30, 1983, New York Times, and I'll try to send this to you, Jim. Recent calculations by the United States Naval Observatory have confirmed the orbital perturbation exhibited by Uranus and Neptune, which Dr. Thomas C. Van Flandern, my parenthetical comment, now deceased, and I wonder why. Dr. Thomas C. Van Flandern, an astronomer at the observatory, says could be explained by, quote, a single undiscovered planet, unquote. Dr. Van Flandern and his colleague, Dr. Robert Harrington, my comment, now deceased, and I wonder why. Dr. Van Flandern's colleague, Dr. Robert S. Harrington, calculate that this 10th planet should be 2 to 5 times more massive than Earth, and later on I'll explain to you why that is not true. That cannot be true, and Dr. Harrington knew that it could not be true. It must be
meaning,
larger.
Yeah, that's a very modest estimate of its size in relation to what has to be the case.
I think Dr. Harrington was prompted to try to downplay the threat because was told, hey, look, this could cause public panic. So you've got to, I mean, I know you're excited, Bob, they probably said to him, about this whole thing because you've been searching for this planet for a good deal of your career. But please, I mean, try to downplay it a little bit because we don't want to panic the people.
Well, I'm sure inversely that if you measured the degree of perturbation that it led them to make the inference, it would be the case that the only way that amount of perturbation could have occurred would be from a far more massive planet.
That's correct. Absolutely correct. And also, when you hear what they have to say about it, they call it a brown dwarf star. All you have to do is look up the definition of a brown dwarf star, look up what mass category of mass a brown dwarf star would fall into, and you see that the puniest brown dwarf star is about 3 Jupiter masses, and the largest brown dwarf star is about 70 to 80 Jupiter masses. Well, 3 Jupiter masses, let's say it's the puniest brown dwarf star conceivable. That would be 3 Jupiter masses. We're talking about almost 1,000 Earth masses, minimum. So when he said, 2 to 5 times, what did he say? 2 to 5 times more massive than Earth, he was really downplaying what he knew to be the truth.
Right. He knew that was false.
Right. So I'll continue reading the quote. Dr. Robert Harrington calculated that the 10th planet should be 2 to 5 times, much more, of course, more massive than that of Earth, and have a highly elliptical orbit that takes it some 5 billion miles beyond that of Pluto, hardly next door, but still within the gravitational influence of the Sun. And I'll just stop right there and say, there is your smoking gun evidence right there. They declare, the scientists at NASA and Dr. Harrington, who is the chief, was before he died, was the chief astronomer at the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. They say that it is within the gravitational influence of the sun back in 1983 when this article was written. Therefore, it's a no-brainer. Look, if you hold a rock in your outstretched arm and release it, you know that rock fall to the ground. Everyone knows that. Likewise, when you hold an object of an object of 1,000 Earth mass within what they tell you, not me, but what the scientists are saying, within the gravitational influence of the sun, that 1,000 Earth mass body must be attracted to that 1/3 of a million Earth mass sun, like a rock falling to Earth. So that thing is coming in. It's a no-brainer, and there's no way anyone, even in cognitive dissonance and denial, can try to deny.
Well,
the inevitability.
But remember, John, cognitive dissonance is a psychological phenomenon. What you're saying is, given the evidence and the logic, it's not deniable. But those who are affected by cognitive dissonance are precisely in the position of denying the significance of logic and evidence in cases of this kind. So they're going to be able to persist in denying by ignoring or suppressing or otherwise discounting these kinds of reports.
But I believe when they hear what I just said, that about a rock having to fall to Earth, there's no way you can deny it, even the ones in the most serious cases of afflicted by the most serious case of cognitive dissonance would be in fear and would know deep down that he's lying to himself by denying the inevitability of this inexorably approaching object.
What other indications do you have in these news reports about, you know, confirmation by highly reliable sources such as the Naval Observatory about the existence of this Planet X?
Okay. Now, we're going to go to what I went and photocopied this, and I also put this on the Internet, too. So you can see the actual high-quality photocopy that I got from my library's microfilm archives at the Morris County, New Jersey Library. I'm going to send both to Jim, and your listeners can access it. In addition to the January 30th New York Times article where they launched the infrared astronomical satellite specifically constructed and launched to find this Planet X, that was dedicated. The infrared astronomical satellite launching was specifically dedicated to finding Planet X. Well, 11 months later, not January 30th, but December 30th, exactly 11 months later, appearing on the front page of the Washington Post. I photocopied the actual article and emailed it in a JPEG to many people. The Washington Post, December 30th, 1983, front page, quote, "Mystery heavenly body discovered, possibly as large as Jupiter, by Thomas O'Toole, Washington Post staff writer."
Now, there he's not trying to minimize its mass the way Harrington was, not saying it was 2 to 5 times the mass of Earth, but overwhelmingly larger.
Very good. That's a good point. I mean, they somehow, the guys with the truth, the guys, the scientists who don't really care about, don't want to lie, they put out the truth, and it slipped past the censors at the National Security Agency. But Mystery Heavenly Body Discovered by Thomas O'Toole, Washington Post staff writer.
Right.
Quote.
What's the date?
Date is December 30th, and I've got the headline banner with Washington Post. December 30th, Friday, 1983. Exactly.
Go.
11 months after the New York Times article of January 30th, 1983.
Okay, go on.
Quote, "A heavenly body, possibly as large as the giant planet Jupiter, and possibly so close to Earth that it would be part of this solar system, has been found in the direction of the constellation Orion by an orbiting telescope aboard the U.S. Infrared Astronomical Satellite, IRAS. So mysterious is the object that astronomers do not know if it is a planet, a giant comet, a nearby protostar." Now, a protostar is an incipient star, a beginning, a baby star. A protostar that never got hot enough to become a star. A distant galaxy so young that it is still in the process of forming its first stars, or a galaxy so shrouded in dust that none of the light cast by its stars ever gets through. Quote, "All I can tell you is that we don't know what it is," Dr. Jerry Neugebauer, IRAS chief scientist for California's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and director of the Palomar Observatory for the California Institute of Technology, said in an interview. He said, "We don't know what it is." Well, that's a lie. They did know what it was, because they told us 11 months earlier in the New York Times that they were looking for Planet X, and they found it.
There's a great historian of science by the name of Neugebauer. I wonder if it could possibly be his father.
I'll bet it is. That's an uncommon name.
That's an aside, but yes. Well, this is very significant. It seems to me that you have these early articles from 1983 in the New York Times and the Washington Post that are really very, very telling. This is very significant, I think.
I will email these high-quality JPEG photos to you of these articles, Jim. I'll continue on. So they say they don't know what it is, but we know Neugebauer was not telling the truth, because indeed they sent up the IRAS specifically dedicated to locating Planet X. Continuing on. Quote, "The most fascinating explanation of this mystery body, which is so cold it casts no light and has never been seen by optical telescopes on Earth or in space, is that this body is a giant gaseous planet as large as Jupiter." So now they're saying not possibly as large as Jupiter, but as large as Jupiter and as close to Earth as 50 billion miles. While that may seem like a great distance in Earthbound terms, it is a stone's throw in cosmological terms, so close, in fact, that it would be the nearest heavenly body to Earth beyond the outermost planet, Pluto. Now, quote, "If it is really that close, it would be a part of our solar system," said Dr. James Hauck of Cornell University Center for Radiophysics. Again, repeat, "If it is really that close, it would be a part of our solar system."
Yes.
Well, there you go. It's being pulled in by Earth. It's being gravitationally influenced by our sun. There's another scientifically documented statement that this thing is under the influence of our sun. And again, anyone who would tend to go into cognitive dissonance must realize that when you hold a rock out at arm's length and release it, it must fall to the ground. Therefore, this thing is coming toward the sun, and there ain't no way to stop it, and there ain't no way to deny it. Denial means death. unless we prepare for it.
Well, it seems there are very few in the position to take the kinds of steps that would be necessary in order to prepare for it. Only the most powerful, wealthy, and influential groups could possibly do that. And you're suggesting that they've actually been actively engaged in this enterprise for several decades.
Well, I will send you, yes, I will send you YouTube links. Governor Jesse Ventura went with his staff and his producer, Michael Braverman, and they did a television broadcast on True TV. I have high quality of...
You're talking about the Denver airport.
Yes, I recorded that.
It was a wonderful show. It was a wonderful show. I thought one of Jesse's best.
Right, and if you go to YouTube, you can see all six segments of that 45-minute program where they go underground, and Michael Braverman, the producer of the program, says to Colonel Wynn, who is the chief of security, over a large staff of soldiers, highly trained military troops with the highest technology weapons.
Which is very strange for an airport. Very strange. If this is a conventional airport, why would they have such a sophisticated security force?
Yeah, right. Well, this was actually in the bowels of Cheyenne Mountain. They went under, they were allowed, I'm surprised they were even allowed under there. Because I know, I believe some people were killed in previous years for even talking about it. Phil Schneider was murdered, definitely murdered. I've got a very well-written documentary portion of that Phil Schneider case in the book by Marshall Masters.
Was this NORAD headquarters in Cheyenne Mountain? Isn't this featured in War Games with Matthew Broderick?
It might have been. I'm not familiar with that.
No, it's a wonderful movie. You ought to check it out. Yeah.
Cheyenne Mountain is where you see that you see the name Cheyenne Mountain over this tunnel in the Jesse Ventura television program, which you can see on YouTube. And they go underground, and then the producer, Michael Braverman, says to Colonel Wynn, the chief of these troops guarding the facility, he says to Colonel Wynn, when the disasters come and the throngs of people start trying to get into this underground facility for shelter, will they be able to get in? And he said, when those 13-ton steel doors, blast doors are closed, you can knock all day long.
Well, of course. Well, of course. I mean, ridiculous. You can actually see the doors in the film War Games. I encourage everyone to watch it. It's an absolutely brilliant picture about how automating a nuclear response could lead to a catastrophe. It's a brilliant picture on multiple grounds, but in this case, it actually takes you inside, at the very least a facsimile, and it's very, very imposing. You know, it seems to me it may be that they actually had access to the real deal, and you'll see those massive doors swing shut, and there's no way knocking would have the least perceptible effect.
Well, the troops, and they've got troops that are ordered to shoot to kill. So yeah, they've made sure about securing themselves there in that underground facility. But there are underground facilities all over the world. The Vatican has believed to have underground city in the Italian Alps. And from what I got from John Moore, who has done also, he's a researcher, a former Green Beret, who has contacts with military personnel, he has stated in his documentary DVD that they are moving the Rome Vatican's library in Rome to a different location. And what is also well documented is moving the facilities of the CIA and the Environmental Protection Agency from the Washington, D.C. area, which is prone to tsunami devastation. They've moved them both out to the Denver area.
Really?
This is what John Moore states. Now, we could probably check that out. We can Google. He said, if you want to check it out, just Google CIA moved to Denver, EPA moved to Denver. In fact, John Moore was saying in his documentary that some of the higher level people at the EPA were actually suing their employer. Can you imagine suing? You must be very
because they didn't want to move.
Because you know what happened? They were they were deprived of their documentation for some reason because it was moved or for some.
They didn't want an official record of some kind.
They couldn't even do their jobs. They were not able to access the documents at the EPA, and they were kept secret.
John, we have to take our final break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, John DiNardo. We're talking about a looming catastrophe in relation to Planet X. We'll be right back.
One day you'll look to see I've gone, for tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. Someday you'll know I was the one, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll...
This is Jim Fetzer, your host, concluding my conversation with John DiNardo about a looming catastrophe that appears to be about to occur, though the precise estimate of the time of arrival is not precisely calculated as yet, though I'll ask about that too, which, you know, appears to be, I mean, given the certainty of the laws of gravitation and of motion that for which Isaac Newton has acclaimed, that this is something that it would appear is going to come to pass. And where my guest has been describing measures that are being taken by the rich and powerful to protect themselves while, you know, benefiting from this private knowledge of theirs, even though there have been some indications from articles in the New York Times and the Washington Post from 1983 that there are very knowledgeable individuals within the government and without who are aware that this is going to come to pass. John, let me ask you this. You mentioned several articles, et cetera, and all that about Planet X. Is there a website where we could suggest our listeners visit for more information about all this?
Well, these articles are at the lightofdayradioshow.com, I believe. I'll check to make sure. I know at least those two articles.
Well, you can always add
the New York Times and one from the Washington Post are there. But I'll double check. And there's another article that I had photocopied from the library from the third largest news magazine in the United States, that is U.S. News and World Report, which I have in front of me here too. I think that should also be posted there.
After Time and Newsweek.
Yes, right. The three largest used to be, at least those.
I think they've been diminishing. You know, they've been losing readership. I mean, television and the internet are just making, you know, tremendous impact on the sales of magazines, which are substantially down. Also, of course, the sales of books as well. So many publishers have been in a quandary.
Yeah, I mean, that's an encouraging sign to me, because most print and print media has been owned by the elite and is used as propaganda organs to keep the people deluded and helpless. Now that people are seeing the internet, they're fleeing, abandoning.
Yeah. Now, just to repeat, that website's thelightofdayradioshow.com.
Correct. And then just click on the Planet X logo.
Click on the Planet X logo. Now, John, we began talking about some problems here, even apart from the Planet X looming catastrophe. Namely, I mean, if you look around the Earth, we have the Fukushima disaster, which is polluting the Pacific Ocean, and who knows how consequential that's going to be. I've even heard reports that the disaster is so great that it might even render the entire islands of Japan uninhabitable. We have the enormous BP disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, where beneath the water, you know, on the crust, the seabed is just coated with oil. It's extinguishing all forms of life there, including the coral reefs. And the consequences are going to be immeasurable, where the information about all of this is being tightly contained. It's as though BP were running the country and not the country, you know, enforcing the laws to regulate BP. And, of course, in the Middle East, we have all this depleted uranium, which is coating the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, which many many fundamentalist Christians tend to forget is the home of the mythical Garden of Eden. And, of course, the effects of this stuff, which has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, which just happens to equal the scientific estimate of the age of the Earth, are so great that we are having reportedly one quarter of pregnancies in Iraq are now stillborn, and of the live births, three quarters suffer from serious genetic defects. I mean, big-time stuff, organs outside of bodies, missing limbs, maybe, you know, no brain, this kind of stuff. It's really shocking and horrifying. And once you get this depleted uranium out there, of course, it goes with the wind. It's blown all over the place. So, you know, it seems to me we have a lot of catastrophes that are threatening the life on Earth, even without Planet X, which obviously looms as the most spectacular and catastrophic of all.
Yeah, you know, Jim, I'm glad you brought up these issues. We need, people who really care, need to take photographs of all these deformed children. What they're doing is the worst atrocity I can ever imagine that has ever been perpetrated against humanity with this depleted uranium. To see these babies, as you described, are so horrific and so deformed and physically damaged from birth, and their parents, too. And we need to get photographs and widely publicize photographs because people today are so, well, first of all, disbelieving, secondly, apathetic. But there is a small percentage of the population who has a heart and compassion. And when they see these photographs, I believe many people will feel motivated to publicize it widely. So photographs are going to be the most important vehicle for alerting.
Well, bear in mind, if the Bush-Cheney administration even suppressed photographs of caskets returning to the United States, imagine the measures are going to be taken to try to keep photographs of the deformities being brought about by genetic mutations caused by weapons used by the United States in Iraq. I mean, it's horrifying.
You're right. And there are a lot of photographs. I can find the website. I remember what it used to be. I'm trying to remember now, but there are numerous websites. One of them is from a doctor. I think it's Dr. Ali, A-L-I, who has presented many photographs of the deformed
children. John, maybe you could add a section to that website of links to some of this stuff, too.
Yeah.
Okay. Of course, Fukushima, I mean, you know, maybe you have a little section about man-made disasters, Fukushima, BP, and DU, you know, that just as illustrations.
Right. In fact, that would have to be a whole new webpage because the first, the Planet X webpage takes a long time to load. That's how big it is.
Yeah.
How large it is.
Yeah.
So there would have to be a whole new page dedicated to the Earth disaster.
Well, why you contemplate that? Right? Why you contemplate that, John? Because I think you're doing so much good here.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jim. And, you know, I would really urge your listeners to get involved. We need people to get out on the playing field because the human race is nearing a point where they are planning to exterminate us. And again, I wonder why, as you had wondered why, Jim, with all these natural disasters, why would they want to exterminate us when the natural disasters will do the job.
Yes.
But still, I mean, they're destroying us with these genetically modified foods. There's rampant disease now. The vaccines are, they're planning to unleash these vaccines on us with a new false epidemic scare, just as they had the scare of the avian flu a few years back. Well, that's going to come out again, and they're going to force everyone to take the vaccine. Now, the vaccine, from what I understand, is designed to combine with the actual virus such that the avian flu is non-communicable to human beings. But it's deadly if you were to take some blood from an avian flu-infected bird and inject it into someone's body, into their bloodstream, they would die because it's a deadly, deadly disease. But, however, it's not communicable by air. So what they've done is made it such that when you take the vaccine, there's a recombinant
DNA, RNA.
Occurs. I don't know all the details of it. Only a microbiology would.
Yeah.
A microbiologist would. But when you take the vaccine, then now when you get the H1N1 flu is transmitted by the air, it combines, and then it becomes airborne. So now, when you go into your supermarket or go into public, you'll be catching a deadly disease that is airborne, highly contagious. And this is the plan. And this is why the elite want to force everyone to take this new vaccine. I did a whole documentary on it. And you'll find out the story that sort of died out, a major story that died out from March of 2009. I believe it's March 5th, 2009. I actually took Alex Jones's entire daily one-day interview and discussion, along with his interview of Dr. Rebecca Carley, where he talked about this plot that they had orchestrated, whereby the agencies, the U.S. government agencies, I forget which ones they were, had created this vaccine. It was highly guarded. It was there was no way that it could accidentally escape or be sent out by accident. Well, indeed, it was. This vaccine was sent out to numerous health agencies, governmental health agencies for countries, about 9 or 10 different countries. One of them was Slovakia, I believe, or Czechoslovakia. And they were trying to get these governments of foreign countries to use this vaccine, which would have killed many people. The vaccine was tested, however, before it was by these foreign health agencies, and found to actually kill the test animals that they tested it on. So the governments were irate and outraged to have received these vaccines gratuitously without even having asked for them. There was a big conflict between the foreign government health agencies and the U.S. government.
Well, wasn't it a pilot study? Wasn't it an experiment on a living population to see what the effects would be?
Yeah, I mean, it could have been even worse, because this thing would have gone viral around the world had they used this vaccine on their people. And then we had the case after that, after March of 2009, that scandal subsided and sort of disappeared off of the news maps. And then we had the terrible explosion of deaths in the Ukraine, and it was alleged to be created by airborne dispersal of this terrible disease, and many people died in the Ukraine. I think it was around somewhere in late 2009. Now I think they're getting ready to unleash this thing again with the mandatory vaccine. So when you folks out there see the government mandating a vaccine for everyone, H5N1 vaccine, watch out! This is going to be
killer.
The kill shot, maybe. At least for one of their weapons and their arsenal.
Isn't there legislation now that renders free from legal accountability the manufacturers of these vaccines, so that if people die from it, they have no legal recourse? I think the Congress has passed such legislation.
Yes, and that is an outrage.
Stunning, absolutely stunning. I mean, how much more could you do to encourage irresponsibility or deliberate destruction of human life? I mean, this is frightening by itself.
Right. And you know, this vaccine that was accidentally sent out, or not accidentally, but deliberately sent out by the U.S. government to these foreign health agencies, they're supposed to irradiate the vaccine because it's actually composed of viruses that are weakened by irradiation, supposedly weakened by irradiation. They did not irradiate this vaccine that was sent out to foreign health agencies, and that's why it killed the test animals, the ferrets. So this was a deliberate attempt to infect large populations in many countries and thus create a worldwide plague. And they backed off on it because they got caught in 2009, but I'm sure they're going to come back with it again. I'm waiting for it to happen, so, you know, people have to be alert to that. And again, with the foods, it's getting so terrible. Our foods are so genetically modified. We have to be very careful about what we buy. I myself am eating genetically modified fruits. I try to avoid because my wife, and we all have relatives who don't go along with us, my wife continues to buy the stuff at the supermarket, so I have to counteract her by buying enough food at Whole Foods so that she cannot overstock with her foods from the supermarket. So that's one of the things we have to do, is go to Whole Foods. And there's an encouraging note there, and that is that when the public starts finding out about all these contaminated foods, because we the few people have been spreading the word, the truth, then the entire population begins to find out about the dangers in some of these foods, and they stop buying them. They boycott them. And I've seen the very positive results in the fact that the corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup, which has been laced with mercury for years and be used in so many different foods as sweeteners, in yogurt, in candy, in snacks. Even in ketchup, in fact, that corn syrup is no longer used. And I saw recently a bottle of the Heinz ketchup, and on the ketchup bottle was a new banner attached to the old traditional label. And that banner read in big letters, "No corn syrup." So what's happening is that people are boycotting the products that they know through education and enlightenment to be detrimental. And as a result, the corporations are being forced to withdraw those detrimental, harmful toxins from the foods. So now you look at the labels of yogurt, for instance. It used to be corn syrup as the sweetener. Now I see mostly sugar. And in ice cream, it used to be corn syrup as a sweetener. Now I see very often sugar. There's your evidence that the corporations are forced financially.
Well, it's like the absurdity with the innovation of margarine, you know, a synthetic product that actually is very harmful to you, where butter actually is very, very good for you in comparison to margarine. And now, of course, a lot of those who realize the hazards of these synthetic molecules are reverting to nature's own, as it were, namely the use of butter.
Right. It's a passive way for the public to fight back, by simply not buying what they know to be the detrimental products. So we need to educate them. People like Mike Adams and Gary Null, health experts and health informationists, are doing a great job of alerting the general public as to these health dangers. So vaccines is another issue, another field of information that we must present to the people, in addition to all the toxic foods that are being foisted upon us.
John, tell me, I mean, with these disasters around the world, Fukushima, Gulf of Mexico, Iraq, and so forth, what can people do to deal with them?
Okay, the main thing is early warning. And I'm glad you brought this up, because I've gotten in contact with a couple people, one through a friend who is a friend who knows a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and there's another person unconnected to him that I've been in contact with. These two people don't know each other, but this other person does oceanographic work. I've heard from both of them what seems to be mutually corroborating information about the seabeds of the world buckling and bulging due to, and I know from my studies of geology, it's due to these mantle plumes of magma coming up through the mantle of the Earth, pressing up against the lithospheric crust of the Earth, and that is the land-based crust, as well as the seabed crust of the Earth. And they're seeing bulges in the Gulf of Mexico. This one geologist, 5 years ago, it's got to be at least 5 years ago, my friend told me that his USGS geologist friend told him, this was a five-year-old conversation I had, that they are expecting land masses to arise in the Gulf of Mexico, islands to come up in the Gulf of Mexico because of these earth changes that are occurring. See, the government knows all about it, the earth changes that are being induced by the manipulative forces of this passing massive brown dwarf star and its accompanying gang of comets, gravitationally and magnetically influencing, exerting their fields, gravitational and magnetic fields upon Earth. And what they see is a line of bulges coming up, starting from the Lesser Antilles, which is a little bit northeast of the northern shoulder of South America, a line of bulges, almost pretty much like a straight line, from the Lesser Antilles, visualize a map now of the Americas, from the Lesser Antilles up through the Gulf of Mexico, through Texas, through Oklahoma, through Colorado, and into the northwest corner of Wyoming, where the Yellowstone supervolcano caldera is located. All these bulges, I should say, coming up, ready to explode, burst forth with methane and possibly even magma, which is a volcanic eruption. And this, it gives us a clue as to what happened with the BP oil spill. That wasn't really an oil spill. It was a volcanic eruption.
I think you have noted at some point that what we have seen, the footage of the alleged oil spill, is actually of a different location than where it's actually taking place, which is far more massive.
Yes, and Matthew Simmons, a high-level member of the oil industry and an insider and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, Matthew Simmons was murdered because he started to spill the beans. He started to reveal the truth. I guess he had a spark of conscience in him. He went on the Fox News, Kevin Rattigan, I think it was, show on Fox TV, and you can see this on YouTube. Just type in Matthew.
Maybe you can link it on your website again.
Oh, okay, right. And in this, he says, Matthew Simmons shows us that famous plume of oil that we saw for such a long time on the TV cameras, of this plume of oil coming up that was the supposed leak from the Gulf of Mexico. He said, that's not the real leak. He says, I saw a white fish go right through that plume. That's a trivial leak. He says the real oil leak is like so many miles away in the seabed, and it's at, you know, different places on the seabed. So by when he said that, he was actually revealing the geological catastrophe that's really occurring in slow motion.
And actually revealing complicity between the federal government, BP, and the mass media, not disclosing the truth about it.
Yes. And a couple days later, he was found dead in his hot tub, Matthew Simmons.
Well, I remember reading about that. John, in the few minutes that remain, what should be the attitude of everyone listening to this about Planet X? I mean, what possibly could anyone do?
We have to try to prepare for it as best we can. In the beginning, we may be able to accept that when the natural disasters are not quite as great, we may be able to escape many of the disasters by getting away from the seacoast. I live about 30 miles due west of New York City. I cannot sell my house. My wife wouldn't go along with it, plus I cannot do it economically. But we can at least keep alert to tsunami threats and be ready to go inland quickly within a day or two. I mean, you could leave the house there and let the house be destroyed, but at least jump in a car with a bug-out bag of basic necessities in the family so that you can protect your lives by just jumping in the car and driving inland
and
a day trip.
And make a reservation for a spot at Cheyenne Mountain.
Yeah. Well, you know, people are buying obsolete missile silos, believe it or not.
Yeah.
People with money. And they're building, you know, little homes down in these missile silos. Why would they be doing that?
Well, that's a brilliant idea, actually, if you have the resources.
People who have contacts with the people in power, those are the ones who find out what's really going on that the public is not aware of. And they're building homes in missile silos to try to escape all this devastation. But we should be alert to get watching for volcanic signs. Now, one sign for people who live on the East Coast, like me, like the 40 million people who live on the East Coast of the United States and Canada and Central America, we ought to be looking at the Cumbre Vieja, a volcanic mountain in the Canary Island chain, which is located off the west coast of Africa. The geologists tell us that that western flank is ready to slide into the ocean. It's a half-trillion-ton dislocated western flank of the Cumbre Vieja volcanic mountain on the island of La Palma. Just remember the spelling, C-U-M-B-R-E, Cumbre. Second word, Vieja, V-I-E-J-A. If you Google that, you'll find out all about it. There's a wonderful Discovery Channel BBC documentary that tells us this thing is going to slide into the Atlantic Ocean like a brick on a well-greased sliding board.
John, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for a marvelous presentation, your clarity, your intelligence, your articulation, the significance of the topic. You've just been a spectacular guest, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate your hosting me and for your wonderful commentary also.
And I want to remind everyone to check out the website, thelightofdayradioshow.com, where you can follow up on some of these issues. Special thanks to John DiNardo for being here and all of you for listening.
Worldwide home of free speech radio. RevereRadioNetwork.com. Total free speech, even when it's ugly.
Revere Radio is listener supported. We need your donations to pay for live internet streaming radio, our toll free call-in number, and our website,